From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Happy New Year. Today on the show, we're showcasing Wisconsinites with interesting stories, starting with a local man who wants to create the juice that made Milwaukee famous.
We juiced to live, and that's what the challenge was. We wanted to live longer, we wanted to live better, and we wanted to have an effect on the people around us.
A Milwaukee couple turns their small home into a micro-farm. Oscar winner special effects whiz and Kenosha native Jim Rigel talks about making the Lord of the Rings trilogy and more. And a former Wisconsin baseball star turns entrepreneur to solve a historic problem. It hurts to catch a baseball.
If you catch it right, you're going to get stung. I mean, that's just where the hand fits in the glove. And so if you catch it right, you're going to get hit right on the index finger and at the base of the finger. And it really does sting, especially when it's cold up.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Happy New Year, and thanks so much for tuning in today. Over the past week, we've been listening back to some noteworthy interviews of the past year. Well, and even though we're into the new year today, we have a few more stories from last year to share with you. Today, we're showcasing some of your neighbors or people who grew up here and have moved away, all doing interesting things. We start on the northwest side for a business that got off the ground around Earth Day. Husband and wife Manon and Joanne Sabir launched a juice and smoothie bar in a neighborhood that hasn't always been known for healthy eating options. It's part of a larger effort being undertaken by the Walnut Way Conservation Corporation to create a wellness commons. Manon Sabir and Walnut Way Program Director Sharon Adams spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich back in April, and Sabir explained then the need he saw in the community from which his project arose.
The Juice Kitchen is a response to the call from our community, and not just a community in a specific area, but a community in response to the city, meaning the city of Milwaukee. And we found that a lot of people were lacking the ability to alternative health and what we call alternative health. And my wife and I, we came up with the idea to start the Juice Kitchen. That's plain and simple. That's the go point.
This is the idea that when people go to the store to buy something to drink, they get the usual suspects are there. There's soda, there's water, there's whatever, but they're lacking an easily accessible alternative.
The easily accessible alternative is a great talking point, because we were driving down the street and my son was sick. It was during a hot day, and we were just got finished juicing with him, and it made him feel better, and it made him talk about what we should name the Juice Kitchen. And we didn't have a name for it, so he just woke up and said, "Hey, this is the Juice Kitchen." Usually, what our main focus is in terms of getting him better is to, you know, sometimes go to Walgreens, grab a one of those over-the-counter medicines that are grape-filled or cherry-filled, and have them down a cup of it, which kind of tastes like soda or Kool-Aid. And we just said, let's juice. And from that point on, it's the Juice Kitchen ever since.
Well, and I suspect this is where both of you will enter the picture here. What was it about your own background that made you and your family the right people to take on this challenge?
As my wife and my daughter, Amira, always say, we juice to live. And that's what the challenge was. We wanted to live longer. We wanted to live better. And we wanted to have an effect on the people around us. And so that was the challenge. The challenge was making sure that not only was my family taken care of, but also the people that were around us, meaning I do personal training. So my clients, people that they were affecting. So it was a kind of a adding effect.
Go back even a step further. Why was juice a part of your life to even begin with?
Well, my grandfather was an educated person out of the South. Right now he's passed away, but he'd be 125 years old. He graduated from fifth grade, then went on to middle school, or what we call still primary school, seventh grade education. He left and started working on railroads, worked on the railroads, had a family. and started studying medicine. And he understood how to take care of people's bodies. And he just kind of passed down those lessons through time. And I think from that point on, my father picked up a little medicine, and I was like, hey, let's take it to the next level. Let's start juicing and putting medicine in the bottles.
Sharon Adams, where does this juice kitchen fit in the bigger context of what you've been trying to do for some time?
In our community, so in Lindsay Heights to root it, which is a transforming community in the city of Milwaukee, we have found that it is so crucially important that a healthy choice is an easy choice. And so the ability to have access to nutritious food that is desirable is part of what we're doing. And so if you can imagine an area that is going to embrace a large commercial development through Walnut Way and partners, that's really about innovations in health and wellness and economic development. What I like about the Juice Kitchen is that it makes sense to children, as you've heard. It makes sense to adults because it's delicious and you feel better. And it is an example of economic enterprise. So in our community, we do have many stories, historical stories, of people that had a natural way of healing themselves. And do we believe that married with current technology, with advanced science, we're really onto something here?
What about the reality of business in the 21st century? The less healthy alternatives are often not very expensive and really all over the place. How do you compete? How do you get out the word that here is this healthy alternative and it's something that not only should you do, but it's something that you can do?
I just want to give one example, and then I think Manan's has multitudes. Manan and his wife Joanne sent out, first of all, media, sent out really a call through Facebook that on a Sunday in Walnut Way at our center, we were going to have a raw food demonstration. Almost 40 people showed up and 8 children. So there is a call and response here. People are desiring a healthy way. And we have supporters, we have mentors that are making this into a business model that works.
I'd like to second that. my wife Joanne is the catalyst behind a lot of the projects that we do in terms of she's just a very detailed, calculated strategist in the sense that when her passion crosses with that, it becomes a desire of everyone, not just myself, but of the entire family and the people around us. Education is key. So when you start educating people, then the word gets out, not only through social media, but through word of mouth. And the word of mouth is a very powerful voice. We found that we were talking so much about health. Every day we wake up with it, juicing, raw food, vegan food, vegetarian fare, and how it affects the biology and the chemistry of your body, that people just started latching on to what we were saying. And after that, we had a following of people, not just on Facebook, but just through our personal connections. And it kind of grew from there. And the call was to do more. And so we have more now.
Was the food or the business end the bigger challenge for you?
Wow. It's 50-50 right now.
I want to speak a little bit more to that business part because I'm so glad that you're talking about business. We really see this as a way to address the staggering unemployment that we have.
How so?
Manan will be modest, but you know, it is relationships and skills. So we're looking at a startup business of perhaps 5 people. But if you begin to do the X factor on that, we're really talking about making some substantial changes. And what I like about the food industry is that you have the start-out places all the way up to the high-tech, really the medicine men. And so I imagine that our commercial corridors will be filled with the whole systems of food, and the juice kitchen represents one. But look at that. That's fresh vegetables. They have to be grown. They need to be processed and cooled. And then there's the advertising. There's all of these components of businesses that this is happening. And it's important also that we bring in capital so that the business succeeds and grows and thrives.
I'll ask you a bigger question about, you know, about flavor development. Is it trial and error? Is it do you have focus groups? Do you turn to your kids and say, what do you like to drink?
I turn to my kids. I turn to my wife. My wife is the biggest, most ardent supporter of juice, but she is my largest critic. I've found that I can give it to my father, my mother, whoever, and people would like the juice. But my wife does not like every juice that is on the menu, which is great because I have a person at home to really tell me the truth from her perspective. But I do say that I like all the juice. I like every last one of the juices, but I do have some trial and error moments that turn out really bad.
Well, what I like about the juices is they serve a purpose. I mean, there are some of your juices, the green juices, those are energy, again, on the X factor. And when you really think about drinking a delicious green juice, it's wonderful. And that they're so available now.
Sharon Adams, do you have a favorite on the menu?
I like the sweet potato juice.
Really? Sharon Adams, you were kind of talking about the X factor, if you will, and how it relates to the production chain. Obviously, you're not growing lemons and oranges in Milwaukee. What about your sourcing? Where do you get the ingredients? And is there an effort to source locally when you can?
There's a huge effort to source locally when I can. The only thing about that is that Wisconsin is very seasonal, and its reach in order to maintain those certain fruits and foods and during those specific seasons where I really need them is really tough.
You can only drink so much rutabaga juice.
Yeah. So we're working with some wholesalers, or we will be working with some wholesalers that have some local reach, but also maybe some national reach that can get the fruit and vegetables to us a little quicker than usual. But we do have some wholesalers here that I do work with that have some local connections.
And even that is an opportunity for business because all of it won't be produced or grown locally, but that's a whole nother entree. And with our community, there's sort of warehouse space. So that's another area of getting people to work.
The location of the Juice Kitchen is an interesting story as well.
Right. So our location will be Amaranth Bakery, 3329 West Lisbon. Dave and Stephanie over at Amaranth Bakery have been the biggest welcoming surprises of our Juice Kitchen.
It's a wonderful story. And Sharon Adams, Manan Sabir, thank you so much for sharing it with us. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Manan Sabir is one of the founders, along with his wife Joanne, of the Juice Kitchen, which began making juice from the site of the Amaranth Bakery on Milwaukee's North Side last year. Sharon Adams is program director at Walnut Way Conservation Corporation. The Sabir's journey started with their efforts as finalists in MATC's Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge in 2012. They first spoke with Mitch Tyke last April. Another Wisconsin couple is also taking sustainability to heart. We'll learn that farming doesn't require a back 40 when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. We're listening back today to some stories of Wisconsinites who've achieved interesting things, whether it's within the state's borders or well outside of them. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz profiled our next couple. In a small home off I-94 on Milwaukee's west side, a family is on a mission to produce piles of sunflower microgreens. Susan takes us there.
So we'll just get one started.
Tony Farrell stands in the middle of his indoor farm as he demonstrates the art of planting sunflower microgreens. He's appropriately dressed for the task, khaki farming hat and work shirt. Farrell fills a double-thick 10 by 20-inch standard greenhouse seeding tray.
Coconut coir about halfway full. Half worm castings, half coir. And then seed.
He broadcasts organic sunflower seeds, only the best for his system, Farrell says, liberally across the soil, then tops the seed layer with worm castings. Worms and their castings, or poop, are critical to the system. In Farrell's words, worm castings
really helps the seeds grow more vigorously and faster.
Followed by another layer of nutrient-rich soil and just the right amount of water from the tap that Farrell has filtered.
So the seeds aren't swimming in water, but there's still enough moisture that it will coax them to germinate.
Farrell slips the tray on a shelf two steps away and covers it with a large piece of corrugated cardboard. They're in the dark, so they'll grow fast and strong. So strong, in fact, within 3 to 5 days under cover, Farrell says they grow and push that cardboard up, up, and away.
Yeah, the seeds have an amazing power to push things up like you wouldn't believe.
That's when Farrell moves the tray to the man-made sun section for just a couple of days until, voila, they're ready for harvest. Farrell raises thick paper sheets, duct tape to the metal shelving. Behind each, four rows high, succulent-appearing microgreens reach for the sky. Farrell's wife, Hillary, says the system is good for plant growth as well as her family's comfort. The Farrells have two sons, ages 9 and 13.
To create the environment nicer for us so we're not staring at the light bulbs and to reflect the light back onto the sunflowers. We have white plastic that goes all the way around our shelving unit to protect our walls. And then we also have the tarp on the floor to protect the carpet. Living in an apartment building, I highly recommend that.
60 square feet of the Farrells' three-bedroom, 1,400-square-foot apartment are dedicated to microgreens and worms. Four shelves are devoted to the scores of worms they raise. They're masterful breaker-downers of fruit and vegetable scraps, shredded cereal boxes and such. Things could be smelly around here, but they're not. Tony Farrell says things didn't always smell so sweet.
Managing smells is something that we have learned the hard way.
It's never been a neighbor complaint.
Really?
I have always been amazed. There is no neighbor complaints.
So you're the complainer, Hillary?
I am the complainer. And my children.
Around 2 years of experimentation have paid off. Still, Hillary admits it took time to soothe her skepticism.
To say the least. My home was being transformed into a farm, and it's a big adjustment. You know, just putting the tray on the counter to harvest. It's you know, we're constantly sweeping and vacuuming around here.
Tony Farrell says early on the venture nearly collapsed when fruit flies and fungus gnats took over.
Literally scattered across the entire white ceiling of our apartment. At that point, I got really, really, really desperate. And I almost just threw in the towel on the whole thing. I'm like, this is just not worth it anymore. I can't do this. And that's when I discovered the Diplomat.
Farrell says the heavy-duty bug zapper transformed their lives from chaos to peace. They've now moved to an inconspicuous, energy-efficient model. 2 months ago, the Farrells officially, albeit quietly, opened their business, Farmer Tony's Mission Greens. All good, according to Hillary.
Well, technically, I own the business. Yeah.
Truth be told, she inspired its birth. Several years ago, she traveled to Kenya on a medical mission. Tony says his wife returned home shaken by the number of children she witnessed going hungry.
She brought back this very palpable sense of a sort of quiet desperation, because even though this type of thing is commonplace for the people in Africa, it really moved us. So I decided that we should do something about it, and that we can.
He enrolled in a commercial urban agriculture class and slowly started experimenting at home. You know the rest, except they're now up to full capacity.
Seed and harvest 8 trays a day, which we figured out would be how much food production?
Approximately 300 pounds of sunflower microgreens every month.
And Hillary says they've experimented intensively with recipes.
We found that anywhere you can put spinach, you can put microgreens. We've tried a lot of recipes, and they've turned out beautifully.
I sample a bit of salsa verde. After clearing my palate, I ask,
what's your vision now of what you hope to do locally and internationally?
Well, our mission statement is to create a world which is free of hunger and poverty.
The two of you are going to take this on single-handedly?
By
not single-handedly.
Teaching everybody agricultural entrepreneurship.
The Farrells figure they can teach people both locally and in time internationally. Tony will be testing his scheme this winter. He's slated to work with a group of teenagers, setting up small-scale microgreen production systems.
Because there's such a quick turnaround, so they can see some success and realize it, and then hopefully along the way we're continuing to develop the market for microgreens, so when they are done with this program and they're 18 years old, they would have an opportunity to become a microgreen entrepreneur.
He says if his microgreens can move cardboard, why can't he change the world? For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Benz.
WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz spoke with Tony and Hillary Farrell, the microfarmers behind Mission Greens, which grows microgreens from inside the couple's West Side home. You'll find a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, Wisconsin native Jim Riegel traveled far beyond his home state to work, all the way to Middle Earth and back. We'll chat with him when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio on this New Year's Day. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. In the past 30 years, moviegoers have come to expect more and more sophisticated special effects, thanks in advances in computer graphics. And when it's done well, it's seamless with the rest of the action that takes place. And Jim Riegel has done it well. The Kenosha native graduated from UWM in 1977 with a degree in painting and drawing. He found himself in graduate school in Southern California at a time when computers were just being employed to create movie special effects. In the 3 decades since, Riegel has risen to the top of the profession, creating special effects for movies such as the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Last of the Mohicans, and Ghost. Riegel was back in Milwaukee in November to be honored by his alma mater, and he talked with us then about how much of the special effects vision in movies is his own versus that of the director.
It's very collaborative. I'm probably employee one or two after the director, because we get started very early in planning the effects for the movie. We'll have a production designer that will sort of influence the overall look, but when it comes to creatures, you know, we'll have a lot of design say in it. Obviously, the director has top say. Gollum is a good example of a design process. So when we were designing it, the creature shop built a life-size maquette or a model of Gollum. And when you looked at it, it sort of looked like our typical alien with the big eyes and the elongated face. And so we built that and we put it into the computer and we started animating it. And every time we'd animate it, because we had Andy Serkis also sort of playing the voice of Gollum. But every time we'd animate this other creature, it didn't look quite right. It didn't look real. And no matter how much we tried to put facial features in it, it just never got there. And so, you know, and we'd be looking at Andy Serkis going, well, he looks fantastic. I mean, that's what he looks like Gollum should be, right? So we ended up thinking, well, let's scan Andy Serkis's face and stick it onto Gollum, you know, or put parts of it like mouth features and eye features, and we'll stitch some of that into the original creature. So we did that and we got it all in there, you know, and then we could see where Andy would make his sort of features with his mouth, we could mimic that with Gollum, and we were getting, you know, close to what we wanted. And it was funny because we brought Andy Serkis in there at one point, and we said, we want to show you what we're doing, you know, and how we're going to accomplish this. And we brought him in, and he saw the Gollum, and he goes, oh, my God. And we said, what? What's are you okay? He said, that looks just like my dad. Because, we sort of featured him enough, and he was sort of this bald guy, and I don't know what his dad looks like, but it was hilarious. So we're always sort of giving and taking with the director, and you know, obviously getting his approval.
Well, how do you begin to work on an effect? Does it depend on? I mean, I guess what I'm asking, does it come sort of full blown into your head, like out of the head of Zeus kind of thing, or are you doing it bit by bit as the process unfolds?
It's a little bit by bit. I mean, for instance, you know. It's sort of hilarious because we're sort of the bad stepchild of filmmaking. I mean, we're probably 90% of a film, but they tend to pretend that we're 5% of the film because they don't want to pay for what they want, you know. So when I first come into a film, and this happens on every film, they'll say, "Well, you know, we're doing this movie, but we're not going to have a lot of visual effects. We're going to shoot it all practically." And I go, great. I said, the more you can shoot practically, the better. It's like, yeah, we don't – probably a couple shots here and there. So like that happened on the current movie, Godzilla, that I'm working on. I'm thinking, wait a minute. Godzilla is a 600-foot creature.
You know, it's like, going to be a few effects in there.
You might need me at a time. So anyway, you know, I let him go down that road. You know, and then when you start getting into the reality of shooting – which I don't know, it's like $250,000 a day or something like that. You know, they'll say, okay, we can't build a giant 60-foot building that's going to collapse on people. You know, you're going to have to do that visual effect. So what ends up is we end up putting giant green screens everywhere. A couple things in the foreground that people can run around on, and everything else becomes a green screen. So it changes over very quickly. So you don't. You don't really plan it, but you always have to be at the ready to make the suggestion for it, you know. So you're always saying, okay, you can't do that. Well, we'll do this up to here. You build this. So it is very collaborative, you know, and you're going back and forth. You know, it's like, well, could you build a little more? And
it almost sounds like you're not getting enough credit for what's happening in a film.
Mm-hmm.
The people who do what you do, that the director gets the credit, the actors get the credit, but then there's the 90% that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and again, there's me, and then there's the 400 people that sort of work under me, you know, that are the real guys that are creating the monsters. You know, I'm basically telling them what to do at this point, and they're actually sitting there on the computer and building,
coding it all.
And coding it all, yeah. So, yeah, there's a whole army that don't get a lot of credits. And there's a sort of a I don't know. It's sort of a catch-22 at this point, but there's been a lot of big visual effects companies that have gone out of business recently. Rhythm and Hues was a big company which won the Oscar for Life of Pi. And the next day after they won the Oscar, they went out of business. You know, so there's a lot of that happening, particularly in the U.S. because there's a lot of subsidies going on in countries like Canada. So Godzilla, we shot all in Canada. Had to go up there for the tax subsidy, which is quite large. It's like 40%. Or you're going to the UK or, you know, India or some other crazy countries to take advantage. And actually other states too, like Louisiana has a great tax incentive. So Los Angeles is sort of hurting now. It's almost like a ghost town in terms of filmmaking. hard to believe, but it's sort of true because everybody goes to where the money or the less money is, you know. And so, you know, there's been a lot of backlash from the visual effects community. It's like, you know, to try to unionize. And it's sort of at this point where it should have been done like maybe 10 years ago. So it's sort of hard to do right now because if you start unionizing, then, you know, you can always go to Canada.
I was going
to
say there's even less work because people are already looking somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's this weird thing where everybody knows we're sort of getting screwed, but, you know. It's hard to sort of do anything about it at this point.
Well, where do you think it's going to go?
I don't know. I, you know, on the other hand, there have been a lot of companies going under. But in my experience in the past 30 years, every company I worked at went under. That was happening 30 years ago, you know. So it's nothing really new. It might be a little more out there in your face because, you know it's a big company like Rhythm & Hughes or what was the other one that went, Digital Domain was sort of a little on the rocks. I don't know. Hopefully what will happen is, California will come to their senses and get a nice tax break.
So as you look back on, the 30 years of work that you've done and the work that you're working on and looking into the future, are there particular effects that you are most proud of, things that you can kind of point to and say, I did that?
Wow. That's really
I know, asking tough. You for about your favorite child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough to sort of talk about. I mean, obviously, Lord of the Rings was sort of the peak of the whole thing because there were just so many different types. I call it the cornucopia of effects. I mean, we had everything in there. We had creatures. We had, practical explosions. We had miniatures. We had,
Everything, yeah.
Pretty much everything, yeah.
Entire worlds.
Yeah, because normally you'll have a movie and it's like, oh, okay, like Godzilla. It's like I have Godzilla and I need to destroy places and, and that's roughly it. You have set extensions and things. But that was – every shot was like, oh, okay, now we have these creatures and they're fighting next to a miniature and we have to put the miniature into a real set. So that's what was – I found most – exciting is incorporating all those different types of pieces into a shot, basically.
And 800 people or so that were working on this for you, right?
Well, yeah, directly and indirectly under me. I mean, in terms of, I did some second unit where I was directing 100 extras, and then our crew was 400 or 500 people, and then the model department was probably 200 to 300 people. So after the Lord of the Rings was all said and done, I found out that over the course of all three movies, there was 25,000 people that worked on the movie. And they said at the premiere, which was held in Wellington, they had a red carpet that went, what's the street, Wisconsin Avenue? It probably went from the lake to, where we are now, this giant red carpet. And they said there was 100,000 people there to see the thing. And I thought, well, that's not a lot. That's like the people that worked on it and their families,
Exactly.
So
when you're working with that number of people and, with that kind of scope, mm-hmm. how do you manage to keep the vision of the director and yourself and the mm-hmm. director of photography? How do you manage to make sure everybody's kind of hewing to what's expected?
Yeah. I mean, it's the pyramid, trickle down effect. So at each department, like in the miniature department, we had a great head of the miniatures. And so I would have meetings with him and the DP and Peter Jackson. And so there was a relatively small group of people that sort of decided the way the effect was going to go. And we'd say, okay, let's make this a miniature and let's do this practical and this. So the miniature department would talk to his people and then that would sort of trickle down. And he was a sort of craftsman in his own right. And the other thing about it is I always call that time working on The Lord of the Rings as sort of the perfect storm. It seemed like all the exact right people were there. And they came from around the world, too. It wasn't just New Zealanders. And they all sort of coalesced to work on that movie, and they really poured their heart into it. And to me, you still see that on the screen to this day. Normally, as you do one film at a time, people will show up. The DP and other guys will be there for a month or two and then sort of go away and you never see them again. You're on to your next movie. But it was this whole group of people that really wanted to be there and really love what they were doing and, died just to be there, right? And I think that really showed, their love of making this film.
Well, as you look forward in your craft, what do you see as some of the new technologies coming up?
Well, there's this thing at the Academy called Cinema 2.0, and which my wife is involved in, and it's sort of exploring where filmmaking is going to go in general. For instance, Avatar and Life of Pi, right? So it's sort of the ones they've been talking about where the DP won the Academy Award for cinematography, but probably 80% of the film was all computer graphics. No DP. I mean, he sort of set the tone, but when it gets in the computer graphic world, it's all those computer graphic artists creating that. you know, it's starting to take a look at, like, when you do digital creatures, we're actually doing digital wardrobe, we're doing digital hair, we're doing digital makeup, we're doing digital lighting, we're doing digital cinematography.
Almost digital acting.
To some degree. I don't want to go that far because that's a whole other interesting concept. But it's getting very gray as to who's doing what at this point, you know. The digital acting, while we can visually reproduce an actor, we can't produce his soul. You know, so I'm saying you still are going to need actors to do what they do. And that's like when you see Andy Serkis, I couldn't have 10 animators do what Andy Serkis did. In fact, it was interesting when we were animating Gollum the first time before we sort of said, let's just copy Andy Serkis because he's great. We had animators doing scenes. And there's one scene where Gollum's sort of looking and talking. And then he goes over a rock and does something else. So we started looking at the dailies, and I saw Gollum, and I said, that's weird. That looks like Linda, one of the animators. You know, it was Gollum. I said, that looks like Linda. And they said, oh, that's interesting because Linda did that shot. And then the next shot, I said, that looks like Hiroki. Oh, Hiroki did that shot. And I'm like, okay, something's going on here. And so you go back to their workstations, and the way that they're animating Gollum is they're looking at a mirror. You know, they're doing the facial expressions that Gollum would do, but it's their expressions, and it would completely come through as them. So you really need that actor to get his, you know, what I call his soul and his expressions out. We can make him look different or make him look, you know, like a real human being, but you can't copy his emotions.
So you need that 20%.
Definitely need that, yeah. We've been trying to get an Academy Award for Andy for a decade now because it's Andy. It's not the animators doing that. It's Andy's performance. And yet they're not allowed to get an award at that point because they're digital. You know, so we're trying to break all those different barriers down and say, well, it was him. And we presented to the Academy as here's Andy and here's Gollum side by side doing the same thing, you know.
So interesting times. I mean, very much a time of transition.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it's trying to, again, break down the old barriers of what we think filmmaking is. And it's going to happen. It's just, you know.
Well, like anything, it takes time to catch up.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you just finished Godzilla?
I'm still working on it. So I'm doing the post now. We're making that creature.
Lovely. And then so what's next after that? Do you know?
I don't know. Yeah, you start realizing you need to find your next job and you start looking. So.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
With that. And it has been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Having you in the studio. And welcome back to your alma mater.
Yeah, it's great.
And I hope that you'll come back and chat with us again.
We will.
Kenosha native, UWM graduate, and multiple Oscar winner Jim Rigel was back in Milwaukee to receive the Chancellor's Recognition Award from UW-Milwaukee. Rigel has been supervisor of special effects on numerous movies, most notably the Lord of the Rings trilogy, A Night at the Museum, Air Force One, and Batman Returns. You can hear more of our conversation, including a story about a special effect that didn't work at first, at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then we'll talk to a Wisconsin baseball player who tries to solve an age-old issue, why it hurts to catch a baseball. Lake Effect returns with that conversation next on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Happy New Year. Baseball season is a couple of months off, but for a former minor league catcher from Wisconsin, the business of baseball is now year-round. Catchers in pro ball are on the receiving end of thousands of fastballs a year, many reaching 100 miles an hour. And a 2005 Wake Forest University study showed that despite the extra padding in a catcher's mitt, catchers still suffer from chronic hand injuries. Enter Lee and Jason Jaramillo. The brothers are Caledonian natives. Lee played baseball at UWM and then in the minor leagues. Jason has climbed through the ranks and appeared in 119 major league games. They are also the founders of a company seeking to change the game for catchers. Racine-based Force Out has developed an internal padded glove to fit inside a catcher's mitt. Lee Jaramillo joined Mitch Tyke in the studio in April and started by describing what it's like to catch a fastball.
Kids nowadays are starting to throw harder and harder every day. It's just what's happening. Baseball's evolving, and it really stings. If you catch it right, you're going to get stung. I mean, that's just where the hand fits in the glove. And so if you catch it right, you're going to get hit right on the index finger and at the base of the finger. And it really does sting, especially when it's cold out, especially when we have weather up here and we can't get outside until, well, what are we now? You know, I mean, we can't even get outside. But kids up in the north have a harder time. Once they start getting outside, it gets really cold, and the hand really does get beat up.
And do we talk about like chronic injuries at the end of a season or at the end of a career?
Well, if you see Jason, my brother's finger at the end of the season, it's noticeably a lot more swollen than the beginning of the season. So you do have that affliction. I've had bone bruises and that last throughout the off season, but yeah, you can totally tell the difference in the index finger.
People who watch baseball, they see catcher's mitts. You have one on the table in front of you right here. They look like they're thick padded gloves, but are they not padded enough where it counts?
They're not. I think with glove manufacturers, they struggle. They're juggling protecting the player but also not being so obstructive. So when they design their gloves, there are glove manufacturers that are starting to put more padding in there, but it just doesn't fit right for the player. So I think they struggle with that. So the advent of the inner gloves and ours now, we think that it's going to be sort of a complementary use with the glove.
And talk about the different parts of the hand as they pertain to catching, because when you look at it, the bulk of the padding is around the thumb. It's around where the pinky goes. Those parts of the hand aren't actually doing the catching, are they?
Right. Like I said before, if you're going to catch the ball in the right spot, you're going to get stung. And so the padding there is very minimal. I mean, the leather is great. I mean, the companies that make them do a great job, but, it doesn't do enough for the player. And it shows when there's studies at Wake Forest being done on this real affliction that it's actually something that really damages, the kids and the players' nerves over time. And so it's irreparable as well.
So when did the light bulb go off that there was room for another piece of equipment that could make a difference?
Well, Jason was playing with the Pittsburgh Pirates at the time. It was 2009, I want to say. He lives in Caledonia during the offseason. So I'd pick him up, take him to Miller Park, dump him off at the loading dock, and he'd be on his way. And so
the glamorous life of a ball player.
Right, exactly. Dump him off at the loading dock. So after one of the games, we started talking. He just started saying, he's getting really beat up in his hand. He wished there was something that he had. And I said, there are gloves out there. He said, yeah, I know, but, I've used them before. They don't do what I need them to do. And I remember playing as well. There are gloves out there that we would try that they claim to help, pad the palm and the finger. It was just too bulky. It was just too much material around the hand. So he never wore one. So what he would do is have the trainers sort of mock up some gel. They'd cut up some gel pieces, insert it there, but it's moving all around and it's breaking up and then you have all these little particles. So we started to think about, hey, why don't we design our own? My main business is commercial real estate and not inventing new products. But being the serial entrepreneur that I am, I said, let's try it out. So we started mocking up drawings and trying to find people that could actually do the prototype for us.
Well, and so the product you came up with looks kind of like a batting glove. It only has one full finger and part of the thumb.
Right. So when we're designing this glove, we want the least amount of material possible. And so first of all, you want to take care of the parts that really get beat up. After that, you really don't need anything else on your hand. And so we designed it such that the middle, the ring, the pinky, and the thumb are free of any kind of material because those are the parts of the hand that actually close the glove. So if you put your hand in a glove and you can sort of kind of do a cutaway of get the glove off your hand, those are the fingers that are closing the glove. So you want to really feel the skin on leather. Tactile sensation, if I go technical on you. We went through many iterations. Jason said, no, this is garbage. Take it back, and he was using it during the season. And so we were mocking up gloves and they were falling apart. But we finally, got it right after a few years of prototyping.
Well, and so within that, you mentioned that those fingers are cut away from it. The index finger, though, has significant padding at the tip and no padding where the knuckles actually bend the finger itself, though.
Right. And there are gloves out there, like I keep mentioning, that they claim to do that, but ours are a little different in that they have individual pads right at the point of the finger, you know, and no pads right where the creases of the finger. So you're able to have mobility and flexibility, even though that index finger really serves no function except to get beat up during the game. You still want it to have some contouring of the glove. You know, a lot of players put their finger outside of the glove, so they want to be able to wrap it around. It's sort of a security for them as well. So it has a little bit of contouring to it.
So as you say, your business was not in launching products and manufacturing them. How did you go about finding the right people to source the materials from and actually build this thing?
Well, it was tough. It was really tough. You know, a lot of research, a lot of, you know, asking around, you know, what are the Nikes and the Rawlings and the Franklins and the Eastons of the world using for their leather? You know, we wanted to use the same type of quality. We didn't want to compromise our product or even we weren't going to put it out, you know, to market. We were just designing it for Jason. All of a sudden it became something much more. So we wanted to make sure, because our name is attached to this, you know, and we wanted to make sure that the materials were of great quality. And so we sourced it and we researched it, and we finally found that the right leather was the Pittard's leather out of the UK that most of these sporting good companies do use. So we use that for every glove, no matter youth or adult.
Well, and so how long did it take to go from this idea and then, you know, a drawing that maybe you did to the point where Jason feels comfortable having it on his hand in a game now?
Well, it took about 3 years to kind of come from the idea to game time, ready to go piece of equipment. But it took a long time because he's a major leaguer and he's finicky, you know, about what he wants to put on his hand. So we needed to get it right.
Well, so you talked to you said, you know, you didn't really know a lot about launching a company to make something and then actually making it. What about distribution? How are you getting this aside from the word of mouth? It's for sale on your website. Is it going to end up in stores someday?
We hope so. We're getting calls from national sporting good retailers now, which is a whole different world to me. I mean, you add on the fact that you're coming up with a product that you know nothing about in terms of getting it out there and actually manufacturing it. Then you have to deal with the distribution part of this whole thing. You know, people are like, why don't you go on Shark Tank? I said, because they'll probably kick me out of there. You know, it's just one product. But, you know, it's one of those things where retailers are starting to call and email us and asking us questions about and it's a – the lingo is so much different than I'm used to that I'm having to Google a lot of these terms and figure out what they're talking about, call people that I know that are in the business. But, yeah, they're calling us and I'm afraid that we, you know, actually it'll really take off and that we'll have to really get things going ramped up here in terms of manufacturing.
Are you the one full-time employee at this point?
I've turned into the one full-time employee. I've got my kids packaging up some gloves at home. But, you know, but other than that, I'm the marketing guy. I'm everything to the company so far.
Well, I was going to ask, the distribution center right now is your house?
It is. We have an office as well that we do it out of. So we do it, you know, depending on when orders come in, we'll fulfill it at the office or we'll do it at home. You know, because, you know, our goal is to really give the customer a really good experience and say, hey, you know, I ordered it at 4 o'clock and now it's at my doorstep the next day. You know, it's really one of those things. But there's a lot of moving parts that we want to hit on. So we are.
Multiple sizes?
We have youth sizes. We have adult sizes. It's for women, men, softball players, fast pitch softball players. We've got a lot of orders from women that are going to be playing or girls that are going to be playing fast pitch softball, which is really nice to see because it's not just a baseball glove and it's not just a catcher's glove. It's for first base, third base, and any other position. And I think because of the way it form fits, people can really say, hey, you know, I can use this at multiple positions. So it's really taken off on all sports and all genders.
You talked about how your brother is really finicky about it, and I would imagine many pro ball players are as well. How willing are they to give something a shot that hasn't been on the market very long?
Well, that's a good question because it's really hard because Major League players are probably inundated with all kinds of product offers. Say, here, try this gum, try this chin strap, try this, try that. But because Jason has credibility within the game, he's able to say to, you know, his fellow teammates, hey, try this out. This is a glove that my brother and I came out. You know, I'm using it and it's working for me. Try it out. So they're more willing to try it. And once they try it, they see the benefits instantly. They feel like they, you know, a lot of the comments that we got back in spring training this year, I went down there to kind of talk to some of the players, is that they feel like they don't even have the glove on. And it's so lightweight and form-fitting that you know, the starting catcher for the Houston Astros is wearing this every day and can't play without it. And so it's starting to kind of take on a life of its own.
Do you have a sense for how many players are using them now?
Not many right now. I mean, our marketing efforts are grassroots right now. We've got a couple players with the Houston Astros. I've sent some over to the Brewers. I've got some friends with the Brewers right now. Arizona Diamondback just sent one out to their catcher as well. So we're starting to slowly get the word out, and it's starting to kind of catch on here.
Do you think is that going to make the key difference that that maybe when some high-profile players start wearing them, more people will take notice?
Yeah. You know, I think it can't hurt. It's one of those things where we're in a really good position because we have that type of endorsement. Jason, you know, he wouldn't wear it if it didn't work for him. So to have those connections and that endorsement backing this, it lends a lot of credibility to our product.
Can you bat with that?
Sure you can. You can do whatever. You can go outside and shovel the snow and rake the leaves. You can do anything in this thing. I'm not limiting myself here to this thing, Mitch. So it's a good product, and you know we believe in it, and we're constantly trying to make it better. And we've got these pull tabs that we have patent pending as well.
I was going to ask about the so you have these little pull tab flaps that that sort of hang down a little bit underneath the cut off parts of the fingers. What is that about?
During these prototypes, we started to talk about it, and I was putting it on myself, and I was pulling it. I was like, this is hard to pull. What can we do? So we came up with the idea of pulling little pull tabs. They're real small pull tabs, and really what it does is when you slide the inner glove inside the mitt, the tabs actually fall down. They kind of flatten out so they don't get in the way at all. When it's time to take off the glove, you just kind of tug on those little pull tabs, and they're a patent-pending design that we came up with. So, and a lot of people that see that part, I think it's a small detail, but it's very important.
You played how many years in the minors?
I played 4 years in the minors.
And played at UWM before that. Is it interesting or does it feel good to you that even though you don't have a major league legacy, you could be kind of touching the lives of baseball players in the major leagues for years to come with something like this?
Yeah. You know, when I started researching and found out there was a real affliction with this whole thing and that there's studies being done, you start to understand the, you know, not just the kind of the in-game situation, you understand that it's a long-term effect and that's irreparable damage that it does to your nerves after time. I'm not saying that this is going to completely eliminate because that would be a false claim. It's going to certainly help. But knowing that we could possibly help kids and college age and high school kids, you know, prolong their career, it feels good. It really does.
The website is pretty slick that you have cooked up.
Yeah. We wanted to make it really simple, but at the same time not look so bland. And so, you know, we'd look at the Nikes, we'd look at the Apples of the world, and, you know, of course we don't have the dollars to do that, so I had to build a website entirely by myself. I knew nothing about website building. But you talk to all these web designers and all these different professionals. It was just too expensive for us. Right now, we're, you know, grassroots. We're trying to allocate the dollars where we need it the most. So I ended up building the website, and it turned out, we've gotten a lot of good feedback. So yeah, we've gotten good feedback from it.
Well, it's really great stuff. Lee Jaramillo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Mitch. Appreciate it.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Lee Jaramillo is the co-founder of ForceOut, a Racine-based company that makes a padded internal glove for baseball mitts. Jaramillo grew up in Wisconsin, played ball at UWM and in the Brewers minor league system. His brother Jason, a former major league catcher, helped develop the glove as well. And I'm Bonnie North, wishing you and yours a very happy new year. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.